A restaurant recently opened up on the plaza, Hogshead KC. But already, one of its interior walls is covered in moss. But here's the catch. The restaurant hired someone to do that. Today, we're joined by the Kansas City artist who installed that wall of moss and learned what it means to use plants for art. Good morning. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're joined by Morton Klinta. Welcome to Central Standard, Morton.
Thank you very much, Matthew. I appreciate it.
So you've written about your process with plants, calling it an art, and I'm going to be honest, I don't know what that means. What does that mean to you?
Well, when I say art, it is because it's the similar process that you would have to any other way of creating art. You're just using live materials. For me, it's almost having a canvas and an easel and a pencil when I especially work with moss. The multitude of texture and color in the moss I'm using is almost endless, and so it is kind of like creating a painting that is similar.
Well, one thing I think about is like a painting or sculpture is pretty instantaneous feedback, right? Like you put red oil paint onto a canvas, you see a shade of red,
right?
You can like adjust it very quickly, similar like with sculpture or something, but with moss or any other living thing, the process takes days, weeks, months to grow, right? Talk to me a little bit about
it. It does. So the two things I've been doing with the Fat Plant Society is that my initial business was with succulents, and succulents is obviously already fairly low maintenance plants that require a little water and little maintenance, and but always had a passion and an interest in succulents. There's over 8,000 varieties of succulents in all textures and colors, so that was my initial. About a year ago, I had a trip to Scottsdale, Arizona, where my in-laws live, and did a tour of several nurseries down there to look at their.
Was that your first trip down to?
No, I've been going to Arizona for years. They've been down there for probably 25 years. So mm-hmm. it's a couple of times a year we visit the valley. But last year was a trip to, of course, see my in-laws, but also to see the nurseries, and came across. A business called Plant Solutions that is kind of one of the pioneers that used moss as a medium as wall art, and they had them in frames in their store, and it kind of piqued my interest. I've never thought about using moss in that way, and started to do some initial research on the moss and how it was to work with and where it was available. So that kind of piqued my interest, and I started to experiment, bought my first little moss, and was actually kind of lucky that I found the guy for moss in the U.S.
There's a guy,
yeah, and he's actually French, but he's been in the U.S. for many years. He's down in West Palm Beach, Florida, but he harvests moss in North Carolina and in Kentucky, and then he has this very secret recipe of how to preserve moss. That means it's kind of, you take live moss and you preserve it. The only thing he's been willing to share with me was that he used paraffin in it. And the rest
what
of
is
it,
paraffin?
Paraffin is a wax, like a candle wax. So you will, when I work with my moss and I get it in from him, you can feel that there's a stickiness to it. And that is part of preserving the moss. And that allows the moss actually to stay green and fresh for 10 to 15 years. So it's an amazing process. And I've said to people that he keeps that recipe like Coca-Cola keeps the recipe to their soft drinks. So
if I'm understanding you correctly, you use a similar recipe for the wall art installation of moss that you do, right?
So I buy from him. I let him do the moss part. So he has he, as I said, buys the moss from growers in Kentucky and North Carolina, and then he does his thing to it, and then he sends it to me, and then I do my thing to it, which is usually to clean up the moss is the biggest process. Is getting the, it comes in with pine cones and pine needles and all sorts of stuff that, and when you open the box, it actually smells like going into the woods of the mountains of North Carolina. It's quite a great smell. And then the process of you know, creating like a painting, taking the moss apart, choosing the color scheme, because you can get moss pretty much in any color you want. I tend to work on green chartreuse. That's what I did at Hawkshead, Kansas City on the plaza. The wall is 28 foot long and 4 feet tall, so it was a large installment. And I had done smaller projects, but I'd never done it on that large of a scale. And it was amazing what you can do once it gets up on the wall.
Well, what's the amazing part to you? Like, what does it do?
Well, it's the texture and the color that stands out when you first look at it. And then you can use lighting is extremely important. You can get it to really stand out in different ways by using different lighting on it. And moss has a couple of amazing abilities, is that especially in public spaces like restaurants, it absorbs sound. And
even when it has that waxy you know, finish on it.
Yep. And actually, amazingly, it still cleans the air like most plants do. They do clean air. So it is still cleaning the air and the space it's in.
But once it's preserved, is it, you know, it's not reproducing anymore. Like its cellular life is over, right?
It is. I mean, if you took a clump out of it, mm-hmm. you could probably get it to grow again. But it is, yeah, sometimes I've used, it's kind of mummified. It's kind of just stopped in time. It cleans the air. It absorbs sound pollution. And obviously especially restaurants or lobbies or where there's a lot of people and a lot of voices, it absorbs it. And lastly, it actually also insulates the wall it's insulated on. It acts as
like
insulation.
Like for temperature.
Yeah,
not
exactly.
Just sound insulation.
Exactly, yeah.
You spent the first part of your life in Copenhagen, Denmark. But
yes.
You have... it sounds like you have such like a commitment to succulents. I'm going to make an assumption here. Like, I don't think succulents are native to Denmark, right? Or are there varieties of that? Like, what got you into
there
that?
Are, like, we have in our area here, there's a couple of varieties. Most people know hens and chicks as kind of your grandmother's succulent pot, strawberry pot.
Because I was just thinking stereotypical, like, cacti kind of thing.
And it is. Usually succulents is obviously grown in low rainfall areas. So a lot of succulents have very shallow roots, and that means that once the rain comes, they can soak up the water as fast as they can because they don't know when they get water again or rain upon again. So, mm-hmm. But it because of that ability, they are great for people who not necessarily have a green thumb. I often tell my
do you suffer from that?
Like, I will consider myself having a green thumb. Yes, I can make most things grow. You know, everybody has, but it's all trial and error. You can't be afraid of failing when you're dealing with live things, and that goes for installing a 28 foot moss wall as well. You haven't done before. You just kind of have to trust the process and fail when you fail, and then fix the problem and move on. And that's how you learn. Obviously, I find that a lot of people get a little intimidated by plants in general, and I try to kind of instill like three basic rules about taking care of plants. And if you can kind of master that, you will usually be successful.
I desperately need that advice.
Okay. I'll give you a little tutorial after we're done here. So it's
simple.
You want to do it here?
Three rules. Yeah,
three rules is correct. So three things is watering is always the most important thing for plants. Plants, you need to understand the plant's need for water. So if you talk succulents, they need far less water. The fastest way to kill succulents is to overwatering them.
I was going to say, I feel like my own fault is I usually an abundance. I don't want the plants to have want.
Exactly. And most people like you have that nurturing instinct that you really don't want them to starve for water. So, but it actually, you love them to death that way. You know, succulents, you know, my company is called the Fat Plant Society, and it's a generic term that kind of describes any plant that stores water in its leaves, which it can feed off of for extended periods of drought that it experienced. So when you see your succulent leaves start wrinkling up and getting mushy, it's actually because the plant is telling you it's time to give it some water. And when you water heavily, you saturate the soil. and then leave it alone until it is completely dry again. So a plant, that's rule number one. Get it on that cycle. Number two is giving the adequate amount of light. It is not necessarily direct sunlight, but bright indirect light is what succulents need. If they don't get it, they start stretching and start looking weird and usually become quite unattractive.
Because they're like, their cells are growing out to try to get to the light.
Exactly. And the last thing is that it's the soil. And I mix my own soil because taking like general potting soil and put a succulent in it, potting soil is meant to maintain moisture in the soil for as long as they can. For other plants like annuals and perennials, you would put in on your patio and on your yard, where succulents, the soil needs to be porous, which means the water exits as fast as it goes in. So because succulents hate having roots sitting in wet soil, so vermiculite, perlite, and peat moss, those three things are the ingredients for good, both for cacti and for succulents in general.
Mm-hmm. Right. And how did you develop your craft? Like, have you always been into plants, or was this something that you came into later in life?
I did. So I was in the newspaper business. I was with the Kansas City Star for about 3.5 years, and I loved my job.
What kind of work were you doing
there? It was in advertising, the newspaper business have struggled. I think I made it through the first 5 rounds of layoffs and got caught up in that about 10 years ago. And then kind of went from job to job and was not really pleased with what I was doing and how I was going about it. So I had a little moment at a certain point where I went down to our local park, Lewis Park, said, pick three things you care about. And for me, it was music, food, and
plants. Wait, you said this to yourself.
Plants. Yeah, it was my inner dialogue. It was in my head.
Were you alone, or were you like hanging out with friends?
No, I was alone. Mm-hmm. Just do some thinking and walking. And I decided on plants. And I got into my car, and I drive out to Family Tree Nursery and applied for a job for, $10 an hour. Took a substantial pay cut with that. And luckily, my wife was good with it. That was kind of I call it my apprenticeship, because I was around a lot of people that have been in business for 30, 40 years and knows a lot. And so I kind of soaked up like a little sponge everything I could in the 2.5 years I was there, and had a great experience there. But from then on, I decided to go it on my own and start it with succulents, and that merged then into moss that I really am working more and more with now. So,
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like the last few years I've seen this, like, it's, I guess for lack of a better term, a trend I've seen on like design blogs and Instagram, feeds, featuring like settings that are, succulent plants are just everywhere.
Yes.
I feel like they're very now. They're very,
they
in.
Are.
And why do you think that they've become such an icon of like the stereotype of millennial design aesthetic? Do you ever thought about like why it is that succulents have become so popular?
Well, I mean, trends are trends, and I believe succulents were big in the 70s as well, not to the extent and the variety that we have now, but for the millennials. I think it's they live busy lives. They use social media. They use they don't watch TV. I mean, they're different in that way. And I think succulents, both for the look and for the ease of care, is one of the things. And then, as you said, succulents have the variety and the texture of it. Just lends itself to either contemporary homes or to I built succulent planters out of old barn wood and more rustic looking, but they kind of lend themselves to anything, any style you have. You just pick the right pot, and I have a thing on my website that I've mentioned that I listened to the plant and I built the house for it.
I was just going to ask you about that, because I saw that on your website that you say like you listen to the plant and then you build. Yeah. A planter for it. Yeah. I'm going to be honest, it sounds a little bit like hippy dippy.
Yeah, absolutely.
But but talk to me about, like, what does that mean to you?
Oh, okay. So everybody can roll their eyes now, and I'll give you a second. Okay. No, I know it was a little cheesy, but it is truly, it's about looking at the plant. Some people go out and buy the pot first, and then they go find the plant. I kind of do, you know, I look at the plant and how to let the plant stand by itself and not have the pot take away from what I conceive the beauty of the plant. And especially for succulents, what I did is that I built these very plain wooden boxes that I call, you know, putting succulents on a pedestal. And that is some of the clean lines from my Danish upbringing, you know, the simplicity in Danish design and the contemporary style that many Danish homes have. Kind of use that and then let the succulent and all the varieties kind of sit there by itself and be the featured artist on the planter. And that's kind of when I came up. I look at the plant and I see what color stain, what material, is it wood, is it metal, is it what is it? So, yeah, that was the process. So,
yeah, and you know, you mentioned, or I think I saw somewhere that moss walls have been used for a long time in Europe. And can you tell me about that history? And is it the same kind of process of preserving them, or are they like actually just living moss walls? Tell me a little bit more about it.
So, I mean, bringing moss inside has been going on for thousands of years, whether it's in Europe or in Asia. People have always had a need, and usually it is in climates where this time of year is pretty dark and short days. In Scandinavia, you bring, you know, tulips and daffodils and so on and hyacinth in around Christmas, because that is, for most people in Scandinavia, it's like, we need to look at something that is, that has color and is as light. I lost the thread.
No. I was just curious about, like, you know, that history in Europe, and like, right. is that important for you to continue here in the United States, or is it something different and similar, but different?
Right. So there's a new term called biomimicry, which sounds very fancy. It is literally trying to look at nature and try to replicate it by using it inside. Bringing a living organism inside that, like moss walls that is preserved, has the look of nature and bring the greenery inside of your space, whether it's your home in a frame or as in Hawkshead, Kansas City, has a whole wall of it. It just softens up any surface it comes in contact with. And so tradition to bring something green inside, and the maintenance, that's the most important thing about the moss, the preserved moss, is that there's no maintenance with it. Compressed air is really what you need. If it collects dust or cobwebs or anything, you can literally go in and just with compressed air, clean it up. I install it in panels. So if it's in a public space and people get fascinated by the moss itself and the installation. When I was working at my workshop, a small nursery on Rainbow Boulevard called Sunshine Flowers, I was working in the back and I had all my moss panels up, and everybody who came in was drawn to those panels instantly. So it was a conversation starter instantly. And, you know, from like, what are you doing? Why are you putting broccoli on the wall? People were just unfamiliar with it but had great conversations. And I kind of knew at that point that people's attention was drawn to it. And that's how, you know, so to go back to your original question, it is something that, you know, it doesn't depend on how much light you have, or you have a green or a black thumb. It doesn't matter. But you can get green inside of your home or your business that is low maintenance. And as I said, color or texture is only limited by your imagination.
You know, there was something that gave me just a little bit of pause when I learned that, you know, the insulation of this moss, for at least in this case, was like preserved. Like that it's like no longer alive. It just becomes purely ornamental. You know, while it may be like beautiful, are you losing some of that authenticity or that connection with nature? I could see arguing it's just another example of like man co-opting nature to suit, you know, his, her aesthetic desires.
Right. For me to have any people get engaged and take some solace and peace from bringing something green, whether it is it's rooted in soil or not, I think is a benefit, because I know it, you know, from Buddhist monks in the 7th century used it for meditation, to sit in a room where they brought the moss in, and there's a peacefulness to it. And as I said, the moss absorbs sound. So if you go into a forest with pine needles on the ground and the floor and moss, there's a stillness. And the moss kind of creates that environment of stillness and peace. And I think everybody needs, in our world right now especially, a time to look at something green. And I, you know, there's studies that says that if you bring either live plants or moss in workspaces, that it actually increases people's productivity. Mm. I'm a firm believer in plants. I will defend the plant.
No matter how they get in.
No matter how they get in. And as I mentioned earlier, people are sometimes intimidated by plants and of the failure. And I just encourage people to try and fail, and eventually you'll get it. And go back to my initial three rules of just know the light in your room, how to water them, and the soil. And then there's a good chance you'll succeed.
Yeah. Well, Morton Klinta, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Morton is a plant-based artist here in Kansas City. And when we return, we all have different ideas of what it means to be middle class and all that could be changing within the next new tax reform plan in Congress. So what does it mean to be middle class today? I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and we want your input when KCUR Central Standard returns. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. As one of the most significant tax bills in recent history gets ironed out between the House and the Senate, there have been a lot of claims about what it could do or not do to the middle class. And when people invoke this term, it kind of has this magic to it. It's meant to mean a particular kind of person and a particular kind of life in America. So we're going to take some time and explore what it means when we say middle class today. We want your perspective as well. What does it mean to be middle class to you? What does that look like? What does that feel like? And has it changed? Call 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888 to join the conversation. Or, of course, you can tweet us at at KCURCST. But in the meantime, KCUR's Frank Morris joins us. Morning, Frank.
Hi, Matthew. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, you recently had a story about capital leaving rural communities, and it brought you to Nebraska. How did you find that story, and what did you find?
Well, so that's a big topic of that's on people's minds when they're rural development folks. So I went to a rural development conference in the spring, and everybody was talking about this giant transfer of wealth that's about to happen, and as baby boomers die. And this is something that's really painful in little towns. I mean, if you can imagine, if every time, almost every time, somebody died where you're living, and most of the time, the families that have been there for generations, all the money left. All the money went to Omaha, or it went to, you know, Denver, or it went where the kids had already left. So you see, this is a gigantic problem for these towns that are already kind of declining, and so. So this is something that's really on people's minds when they're doing, you know, rural development. Again, the issue of inheritance following the children who leave these towns, these little towns, for better opportunities, more out, you know, for easier lifestyle in cities.
And is it something you've seen? You've witnessed it? Have you witnessed it happen?
Yeah. I'm from a little town, and you know, I mean, it happens all the time, because there's so many little towns, and they were all in the plains where I'm from. You know, they were all built around the 1860s, 70s, 80s, when the railroads, when there were lots and lots of little farms around these towns that all depended on the town. You know, everybody did their business in the town, these small farms with big families, lots of people, lots of kids. And that whole economic system is completely gone. And now you have great big farms run by just a few people who aren't necessarily as dependent on the towns anymore. And in fact, they're a lot less dependent on the towns. And so the opportunities, the economic opportunities in the towns just aren't there for a lot of people. It's a much different environment. And so, you know, people have been leaving little towns for 100 years or better, more than that. And
ever since a young man could dream.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just and it's almost like an expectation, you know. Unless you have some big inherited farm that you're going to get and you're expected to take over, you know, if you stay in the little town, everybody knows your horizons are going to narrow somewhat. And, you know, there are good reasons for staying in little towns because of your friends and your family and the atmosphere. But economically, it's a harder way to make a go of it. Things are cheaper, but your wages are going to be lower, and the opportunities to do different things, like be a radio reporter, just aren't going to be there.
I was going to say you've left in some ways, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
And was it like an economic calculation for you? Was it an emotional calculation for you?
For me, it was just like get me out of here, you know. Mm-hmm. But because some people don't like the closeness of a little town, or right. the, you know, you want broader social opportunities too. So that you know, it's different for different people. But there are solid economic reasons why people who are at their top producing, you know, who have acquired skills and who have marketable skills, they really have to take a pay cut, honestly, to live in a little town.
And so, what does being middle class look like to you? Do you feel like you had a middle class upbringing in a rural community? And
totally, yeah. I mean, we were. I mean, my dad worked at a salt factory, a salt plant, Morton Salt and Hutch, and my mom was a school teacher, and we had a, you know, sort of a modern house. Our house was only like 15 or 20 years old, and it really seemed new compared to a lot of the other houses in town. And we took a vacation once a year, you know. And so we had some time. Our cars ran, you know. We never got new cars, but our cars were always good. So I could tell. I really felt, you know, very solidly middle class growing up in this little town. But there wasn't in a little town. You got to understand, there's not the same kind of social strata. Or at least where I grew up, you know, everybody was in together. And so you knew that you kind of had some sense that some people are really poor and some people are pretty well off, but there wasn't a whole bunch of like, oh, you're middle class, you're not, you know, everybody was kind of in it together to an extent, except that I knew that, you know, like I said, not very many people that I grew up with went on vacation ever. And you know, we did. So. Mm.
And, you know, you've done a lot of reporting in rural parts of the Midwest. Does middle class, does what that look like or the experience of it, does that change depending on where you've been?
Well, I think it changes by region, you know, and I'm more familiar with the plains. That's kind of where,
yeah,
and the Midwest. But I think that, you know, I think it's harder to be middle class now in rural, and like harder to be middle class everywhere. And to me, you know, I don't know, this is just me, but if you have middle class income, but you're working three jobs and you've got a ton of windshield time between jobs and all the scheduling, that to me, that's not quite middle class, because middle class implies a bit of free time. And that's where you see the sort of social fabric fraying in some of these little towns, is where nobody has any free time anymore. You know, either they're scrambling to get by, and when you don't have free time, you can't do this, you know, help the society. You can't volunteer. You know, you can't. So there's no 4-H club if there are no volunteers. You know, all these little towns run on volunteer fire departments. And those things are really, really struggling. So there's definitely a lot of pressure on the middle class, and the middle class as defined as someone who not only has a measure of financial security, but who has a bit of free time.
Right. And I want to bring in two other guests now. Doug Bowles, he's the Associate Director at the Center for Economic Information at UMKC, and Tracy Gleason, the Director of Communications for the Missouri Budget Project. Welcome, Doug. And welcome, Tracy.
Thanks for having me.
And so as you guys been listening to Frank, has there been anything that's resonated with you, Doug?
Oh, of course. Having lived in the United States and in the Midwest for the last 65 years, what Frank's described sounds quite familiar to me. You know, I've watched this process. Although, from an urban perspective, I'm not really... I don't have the same kind of small town background that that Frank describes. Although I did grow up and go to high school up in St. Joseph, so and my parents were from farming families, so there's a little bit of that in my background. But simply as an observer of American society, that all sounds quite familiar.
Mm-hmm. And Tracy, what is?
Well, the thing that Frank said that really struck me was the concept that it used to feel like we were all in it together. And I think with some of the rise of inequality that we have seen over time and some of the class segregation, if you will, that has increased, that we live our day-to-day lives generally around people that are like us economically, educationally, socially. And so I think that that has really had an impact on how we perceive the middle class and how we fall in to that range. You know, we've got plenty of numbers about it, but it really is kind of a value-driven concept for what people expect if they have achieved the middle-class lifestyle.
Right. And Doug, you know, from an economic perspective, like, right, how do we define the middle class in, like, the world of economics? Is there a shared definition of what that even means?
Well, I think the easy answer to that is yes and no.
It sounds like a difficult answer.
Right. First of all, I'm going to approach this from the perspective, not strictly as an economist, but as a social scientist, someone who has studied economics, but also has studied economics as a social science.
Right.
And
yeah.
So the first thing I would want to try to the first kind of point I think I would want to try to make is that the idea of class is, from an academic perspective, has a history of study as a field in the discipline of sociology. There's a field called social stratification in sociology. It's a major subfield. And social stratification could be fairly succinctly defined as structurally unequal distribution of power, wealth, and status by race, class, and gender.
Okay.
So that field is the framework for really, I think, anyone who wants to, you know, approach the subject from an academic perspective. Economists have a more limited view of things.
Right.
I would
imagine that it's like probably based on numbers and mean,
income,
median, and mode.
Income, most likely, right? Most economists would probably want to approach class as a measure of income, right? Now, this is not uncommon. However, the point I would want to make is that if you try to, and this would be my critique of, let's say, mainstream economics, that you can't really effectively define class in those terms, because to understand class, you have to understand that it's a relational concept. Classes are related to each other. Mm-hmm. There are class relations that exist, and if you try to define class in a way that ignores those social and economic relations, you're missing important aspects of it.
And that's interesting, Frank. Well, I was just thinking about you, Frank, because you were talking about, and Tracy, you were mentioning this as well, like that idea of like being together, like all in it together, that relation, there was class where you grew up, Frank, but you didn't perceive it like having as much of a relational tension. Yeah.
Right, right. I mean, and I think that's partly of, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, but it's also a sort of part and parcel of small towns where, you know, you just can't, you know, everybody goes to school together, everybody goes to the post office, everybody shops together. And so there is a different, we didn't have social cliques really in my high school nearly the way that, you know, say my wife Laura did in suburban Kansas City. So I think that's partly a small town thing. But yeah, I mean, I guess it you know, I don't know what the definition is. I mean, is there a dollar definition for middle class? I mean, is there a, you know, here's, you know, the as far as the U.S. government's concerned, or you know, you're middle class if you make, you know, a median household income, your household income is over 50 or what is it?
The U.S. government specifically avoids defining class and using income to do it, or any other way of doing it. Uh-huh. There are tons and tons of social and economic indicator data programs and systems out there that the federal government and other parties produce for us. But as far as the federal government is concerned, there's no position whatsoever on the subject of class.
And that's interesting because, I mean, we hear politicians all the time, and particularly most recently, you know, both on the left and the right and everywhere in between, saying, you know, like, this will hurt the middle class, this will help the middle class. And Frank, do you have an idea about, like or do we have a shared understanding of what that means?
I mean, it's you, basically. Everybody, you know, assumes the middle class is, that's me. You know, I'm middle class. And so, I mean, I think that's what politicians talk about it all the time, because they're saying you, you know. But yeah, if this middle class is kind of this floating concept that people have different ideas about, then, you know, who's to say?
Yeah, Tracy, you were nodding your head, please.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in because I do think that that's important. You know, when it's used by politicians, it's trying to appeal to whatever policy they're trying to sell. And there's that aspirational aspect of being middle class. So if you're on the lower side of the income scale, you're hoping to reach there and you want to believe you've achieved that American dream. And if you're doing really well, you've surrounded yourself by people who are doing even better. And one anecdote I heard is, you know, when your neighbor then gets a house on the lake, well, I'm not rich. I don't have a house on the lake. And so it's that comparative aspect. And everyone wants to be that because we have this pride in it, you know, through American history that we have achieved. If I can take a second to look at a couple of numbers, though, that I find fascinating. If you look at Johnson County versus Jackson County, and again, there are all sorts of metrics to define, but one metric that is sometimes used is anyone between the 30th and 80th percentile of incomes. And in Jackson County, that means you make between $28,000 and $93,000. But if you go across the state line, it means you make between $48,000 and $140,000. That's a huge difference by crossing a street. And we're all, you know, living in that same society, but economically, just those two counties, there's a wide variation in the income groups.
And I was going to ask, you know, Tracy, tell me a little bit about what the Missouri Budget Project does and how you view the middle class.
Sure. Well, we are a statewide public policy analysis organization, and we primarily study state budget, tax, and economic issues. We want to see what the impact is on all Missourians, because in order to make good policy, you've got to have good information. And we feel like that public engagement piece is very important as well. You know, a lot of what we have been working on lately, we won't go and get into the weeds on the tax bill, but what are the impacts going to be? Because families feel like they're struggling. They're having those proverbial kitchen table conversations about how they're going to afford childcare or send their kid to college, or worried about the medical expenses that their parents are starting to face. And are they going to move in? And what's that going to mean? And can someone keep working? And, you know, a lot of these policies that feel really arcane to us are having a huge impact on our day-to-day life. And in Missouri in particular, some of the cutbacks that we have made are making it harder and harder for families to stay afloat. The median income has dropped over time particularly for the middle class and lower end of the spectrum.
And
where,
when you say middle class, you're defining that as between 30th and 80th percentile.
Well, in the example I gave earlier, I pulled some numbers in preparation for this, and yes, everybody uses something different. But I think no matter how you define it, the middle class is not doing as well as it used to be. So no matter how you define it economically, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Frank, it's always a pleasure to share some time with you.
Matthew, I feel exactly the same way about you.
Ah, well, Frank Morris is KCR's national correspondent, and he's a senior editor here. His story on rural communities attempting to preserve the wealth built in their communities can be found at kcur.org. And when we return, we'll dive into the numbers and the history of what it means to be middle class. We want your perspective as well. What does that look like to you? 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're exploring what it means to be middle class today, inspired by competing claims about what impact in the works tax bill may or may not do to the middle class. Yesterday on Up to Date, they dug into the nitty-gritty of the details of the various implications of those competing bills and their potential impact. But right now, we're focusing on who exactly is the middle class anyway. We want your perspective. What does it mean to be middle class to you? What does that look like? What does it feel like? And has it changed? You can join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888 or tweeting us at KCURCST. We're joined again with Dr. Doug Bowles, from the Center for Economic Information at UMKC. Doug, welcome back.
Thank you, Matthew.
And so you say, stratification is like an idea that you introduced in the last break a little bit. Did that begin a long time ago? Is that something we've always lived with as humans, or is it kind of a new development?
That's a really super question. It doesn't go back to the very origins of the human race. I mean, I think probably the best way to try to describe it in a shorthand sort of way would be to look back to the era during which human society was what we would call hunter-gatherers, right? And we lived in a tribal sort of societies, and we had what you could call a subsistence sort of economy, right? You collected what you hunted and you gathered and you consumed, and everybody pretty much participated in that, and that was what we would call a subsistence sort of existence,
right?
And it's not until probably the agricultural revolution, which can be traced to somewhere in the Mideast, right? And we learned to grow crops and stay in one place and construct, permanent dwellings and grow crops and raise livestock, herding animals. And we began to produce a surplus sometimes, right? And it's with the production of the surplus that stratification begins to occur, because different individuals who occupy different roles in the social structure have different capacities for, let's call it, appropriating a share of the surplus, right? And that's really what defines stratification, which is what defines social and economic class. At least
it's about
who holds the surplus, right? And you remember I mentioned earlier that there are these class relations that you have to take into consideration, right? Let me give you just a really quick rundown on what a class structure would look like using these concepts, right? We've got a property class, we've got middle classes, we have working classes, and today in our society, sometimes we have what's sometimes referred to as an underclass, right? These large, and notice I'm using plurals, right? We're not talking about a middle class, we're talking about middle classes or working classes, right? Okay. So very quickly, the property class owns enough of the surplus that they can live off the income if they choose, right? You're not necessarily going to do that, but you can live off the income, not off the wealth itself, but off the income of the wealth. And you're going to live at a certain socially determined level of consumption or standard of living. The middle classes, historically, are the entrepreneurial classes, which is what Marx called the petit bourgeoisie. And then with the development of the corporate economy, the bureaucratic forms, a couple of other the new middle classes evolved, and those are the professional and managerial classes, right? Now, the thing that they all have in common that makes them the middle classes, whether old or new, is that these are the occupations that have the capacity to appropriate surplus and acquire surplus and potentially join the property classes.
But they don't.
One quick thing. This doesn't include your 401k, because if you're saving for retirement, you're going to consume that eventually, right?
Right, exactly. And Tracy, you wanted to jump in here.
And I want to jump in on one point, but just to that last point. Yeah, I think some of our conversations about income don't necessarily include kind of some of that property aspect and wealth outside of earned income, as well as the role of debt in all of this. But, you know, to who holds the surplus, I think we need to keep in mind that we have had a lot of policy decisions over time that have helped shape who has access to being able to acquire that. And, you know, America didn't develop a middle class or classes that was the envy of the world by accident. We made a lot of choices along the way that both helped develop and now, unfortunately, have weakened the middle class. You know, being able to send your kid to college, GI Bill, there were all sorts of things that allowed the middle class to have the lifestyle that we all have in mind when we talk about it. And one, you know, statistic that I don't remember but has always held sway in my mind is when you look over time, this idea of that we're all in it together, the ratio of pay for a corporate CEO versus the worker has ballooned since the 1950s. And, you know, I think those are some of the policy decisions that have just made it harder and harder for kind of your average working family.
Right. And I want to quickly get to a call. Hugh from the KC Art Institute. Hugh, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting conversation.
Yeah, and briefly, how do you define middle class?
Well, I've done a lot of work in the East of Troost, and that, of course, is a euphemism for saying in the black community. Mm-hmm. And so let me try to put it this way. If we were to take a month's income and see how a family spent that money, you would have folks who are in the underclass, poor, who would not have enough money to pay the car payment, the rent, food, the regular electric bill, and therefore they fall deeper and deeper into debt until they become homeless and destitute. Then you have the working poor that can just scramble and manage at getting those bills paid. And as you move up to the middle class, and I think this is true of the guys who came home and women who came home from World War II, that the expectation was that you would buy a house, that house would become income for the future for both retirement and for sending kids to college. There were 401k plans. In the old days, there were unions that had pensions. They had health care. So at the end of each month, there was actually money to be put into accounts that would allow for wealth to grow. And I agree absolutely that there are all kinds of decisions that have been made to systematically grow that system, but they certainly don't grow it in the African-American community. The covenants of nickels, not allowing black folks to buy homes, has today produced a more inequality.
Right.
So,
Right. Sorry, Hugh. We have to wrap up our show. I want to thank Dr. Doug Bowles, the Associate Director for the Center of Economic Information at UMKC. Thank you so much, Doug.
My pleasure.
And Tracy Gleason, the Director of Communications for the Missouri Budget Project. Thank you so much, Tracy.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So that's it for today's show. You can listen back to our conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also catch yesterday's Up to Date, which dug into the nuts and bolts of each tax bill and its potential implications. And tomorrow, we'll bring you the story of one of the world's best big brass bands right here from KC in a conversation with the concertmaster of the KC Symphony. KCUR is produced by Coy Duggar, Jen Chen, Sylvia Maria Gross, and myself. And our intern is Tom Taylor. Gina Kaufman returns tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody, and stay with KCUR. Up to Date is next.